we were out and we needed some. So I had gone to the store and I bought yams and I peeled the yams and I put them in the steamer basket and I walked away and I set a timer and I went back to my desk because I mostly wasn't working in the kitchen. I was just like helping out by getting the yams steamed. Mm-hmm. And about, I don't know, must have been 45 minutes later, Justin, who is the assistant kitchen manager at Kind, came into the staff room, which I've kind of been using as my office because it's nice and sunny. And he's like, hey, how long have those yams been steaming for? And I was like, oh, shit. Welcome to Food Court. This is a podcast with Shale McDonald and Alan Sutterby.
Hello.
Hi, Alan. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it, and that's what we're going to do right now. So I like jumped up from my desk and like ran in, and then I could see that there was like a little bit of steam coming out of the I had saran wrapped the top of the pot. I put a steamer basket inside a pot. We don't have a ton of cooking implements. So I had a bamboo steamer basket. I put it inside of a deep pot with water in the bottom, and then I covered the top of the pot with saran wrap. Mm-hmm. And I could see there was a little steam coming out from around the saran wrap. But I could smell something burning, and I was like, oh, man, I don't know. So I like walked over, and I was like, well, there's still steam coming out, so maybe it's okay. And then I like took a whiff. I was like, nope,
it's smoke.
That's smoke.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I took it over. We have like a little ventilation hood over our oven, and I put it under there, and I took off the saran wrap. But it really, really stunk up the place. And then the bottom of our steamer basket now, like the whole outside ring of it looks like it's like been treated with a wood burning kit. It's right. Like, yeah, pretty cute.
Is so that's, was the, did you forget about it, or just the heat was set too high, or what?
Both. I had let the heat set too high, and somehow it's pretty common for me to set a timer and then have it go off and to turn it off and completely ignore it.
Shale.
I know. It's horrible.
You need a snooze alarm on your timers. You know what
I mean? It's unprofessional is what it is, Alan. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it happens. There's just so many timers in my life that sometimes I'm like overwhelmed by timers, and they just start to mean nothing. It's like when you say the same word over and over again.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my funny joke.
When you started that, it's a good story. It's not a joke. It's definitely not a joke.
Oh yeah. No, you're right. It's a story.
But I did think, so there's actually a handful of jokes like that I find myself probably annoyingly to the people I work with, that I basically repeat every time the opportunity affords itself. So like, for instance, if someone puts water on to blanch veg or whatever, and it comes to a boil and it keeps boiling and they don't turn the heat down or get their blanching done, I actually can't remember who taught this to me, but I always walk by them and say, your water reduction's almost ready. There you go. What are we going to talk about?
This is the question.
We have unfinished business.
We do have topics, right?
Yeah.
So actually, we kind of have a, what's the word? Mandatory topic is how I would put it, I guess.
A to be continued topic kind of thing. Is that what you mean?
To be continued. Yeah. Kind of a cliffhanger topic that obviously if we don't follow up on, probably going to get a lot of, I mean, honestly, it would be pretty cool to get a lot of hate mail, but
no bad publicity.
And that topic is guilty pleasures. So what does that mean, Alan? Guilty pleasures. What are we talking about? I think we kind of maybe went over it a little bit in the last episode, but let's get into it.
Well, it's food that you enjoy eating, but you feel bad doing it.
Okay. That makes sense.
That's kind of like a Webster's definition. Do you have anything to add to that definition, though? Is there anything else?
I think that's a really solid, clear, succinct definition. So I don't really have anything to add to it. That's what I think of when I think of guilty pleasures as well. But I guess, well, I kind of feel like this conversation can go in a couple of directions. And I don't know, maybe it should go in both, but I guess maybe I don't know where to start. I think that it'll be fun to talk about some of our foods that we eat that we feel bad about eating. But then I'm also real curious about why we feel bad about eating them.
Yep. Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe that can be like a secondary topic. After we unburden ourselves of all of the guilt from all of the foods that we've that we've eaten hiding in a dark corner,
mm-hmm.
so that nobody will see us. And if someone shone a light on us, we would hiss and say,
"Yeah,
my precious." Then we can go on to maybe psychoanalyze or like pop psychoanalyze each other about why we feel bad about it.
Sure. Well, I think, okay, maybe I'm going in the wrong direction then. But like when I sat down to think about a lot of my guilty pleasures, I realized that I used to have a lot more than I do now. By which I mean, I used to feel guilty about a lot of things. Sorry, I used to feel guilty eating a lot of things that I don't feel guilty about now.
Right.
Any longer. So for instance, like when I was first in the first few years of cooking professionally, and like
mm-hmm.
partly because I, you know, took myself very seriously, too seriously.
Very serious man, Alan.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But also because, and actually we did record a conversation about this, but it never made it to air. But like one of the kind of like movement that I came up in, what like one of the most influential things in my early days of cooking was the 100-mile diet, like the book, the 100-mile diet.
Right.
Which like I still love, but it like eschewed industrial food for food that you had a much more personal connection to. And so for a long time, food items that I ate daily or weekly growing up and really loved, like I would never buy. So just things like processed cheese or orange cheddar or like marble cheddar.
Right.
There was like a stigma to it, like, 'cause it wasn't artisan cheese or whatever. And like, I don't know, ketchup, like French's mustard.
Factory cheese.
Yeah. Yeah. But so that was a phase and like,
Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off,
no.
But are you saying that there's like a point in your not too distant past that you wouldn't have had a bottle of Heinz ketchup in your fridge?
The ketchup, no. I think the ketchup would have always been there at home. But there was definitely a time where like I was working for or with an establishment where it made total sense for there to be a bottle of Heinz ketchup on every table or for at least it to be available to every customer,
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't, or there was, and here we go into this conversation, or there was a homemade version that was deemed to be like more appropriate to our culinary sensibilities. But now, so like the Heinz never left my home refrigerator, but in a professional setting, there were places that it wouldn't be served.
Okay. I got you.
Even when it made, I don't mean fine dining places. I mean like cafes and very casual restaurants where it made total sense to have it. But instead we like made our own, and it wasn't as good as Heinz, but it was at least homemade.
Who decided it wasn't as good as Heinz?
Me. Even when I was the, you. Even the one that yeah. I was making it, even when I was the one making it, it wasn't as good as Heinz.
Yeah.
But I do think that French's mustard, there was a long time where I would only buy Dijon mustard, or it doesn't have to be Dijon, but like I wouldn't buy French's mustard, but I got over that. Cause it's just very powerful nostalgia with hot dogs and sausage rolls, French's mustard.
Yeah. I love it too, Alan. Okay. Sorry, how did we get on that?
Well, you said we need to list the guilty pleasures and then psychoanalyze why we felt guilt about them, and then I didn't listen to you. And
then we went off on psychoanalyzing.
Yeah. So like what I'm saying kind of plays into the little hot dog story we had at the end of last episode, that like there was a chef who didn't want anyone to see him eating hot dogs or know that he enjoyed hot dogs. And that was kind of what was happening with me, with a bunch of, especially with some like so-called lowbrow industrially produced.
Totally. Yeah. I've worked in a lot of kitchens, most of them I would say, where you don't really want to tell anyone that you ate fast food for dinner or lunch,
right,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You get shamed for it or something like that, which, I mean, there are a lot of problems with fast food, obviously, mm-hmm. and I understand those problems. And I've gone through various phases of my life trying to either phase out eating fast food completely or trying to reduce it, and then other times when I just really couldn't be bothered. And so, yeah, I guess like for me, probably I would consider fast food to be a guilty pleasure, even though... Mm-hmm. Everyone eats it, and well, maybe not everyone, but just about everyone, and definitely like people who aren't in the industry. Well, people in the industry too, but like people who aren't in the industry and don't have a lot of exposure to food politics and things like that, mm-hmm. Don't think twice about it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. I think that's kind of, it's a huge category of the food that's available to people in North America. And yeah, I mean, I think for me and for a lot of cooks, it's a guilty pleasure because of some of the like shaming and guilting that goes on in kitchen culture, which is, I don't know, it's interesting.
I think, so yeah, fast food generally, but yeah, McDonald's would be definitely a guilty pleasure. I think there's three elements to the guilt of eating at McDonald's. The first one is like, again, coming up like with the 100-mile diet, the feedlot image, the feedlot, like how terrible that is for the animals that have to live and die in that environment, and the environmental impact and things like that. That's one element. Another one is the, like, it's not good for your body. And that's, again, like when probably right shortly before I started cooking, there was the documentary Supersize Me, about the, terrible health impacts of eating that food regularly. But then, yeah, the third prong that you mention is like being a member of the independent like food service scene in Edmonton, and especially during COVID, where you see a lot of like the big chains are doing all right now, but it's the small local and independent shops that are having a really tough go of it. So yeah, there are many compelling reasons to not frequent fast food and McDonald's. But yeah, I'd be lying if I said I never ate there. So yes, guilty pleasure. That's the guilty side. The pleasure side is that like the Big Mac is one of my, I don't know. I love Big Macs, and there's actually, have we talked about this before? There's like a section in the first Joe Beef cookbook about the, it's called the Big Mac Equilibrium.
Okay.
And they argue that the Big Mac is like the exact like balance of salty, sweet, and sour for the North American palate. And so like it's almost something that you need to emulate if you want to cater to them. Anyways.
It's interesting. I don't know if I totally agree with that. Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's probably a matter of personal taste, but to me, a Big Mac always seems like it doesn't quite have enough of the beef aspect.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
And like, if it just had a little bit more, I mean, like, unless the only way that I ever feel like there's enough meat, or in some cases, I guess too much, is if it's oversalted, like, which happens sometimes. You know, in which case it's pretty present because of the saltiness of it. And it's like bringing a lot of the salt to the party. Oh, man, right. I sound like Alton Brown. but yeah, like I feel like if the beef is like seasoned the way that it should be seasoned, then there's just not quite enough there for me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I would say like I tend to enjoy McDoubles more than I enjoy Big Macs, because there's, that to me is like a better balance for a burger.
Is a McDouble just like a quarter pounder with two patties, or what is it?
No, it's like it's a double cheeseburger.
Oh, okay. The
quarter pounder with two patties, that's intense, Alan.
But
you eat that?
So sorry, the cheeseburger patty is less than a quarter pound? Is that, or what's
A cheeseburger patty is a tenth of a pound. For anyone who doesn't know, my first job was at McDonald's.
I did know that. So hold on. A quarter pound, so that's a 4 ounce patty. And a cheeseburger is just a tenth of a pound. It's a 1.6 ounce patty.
That's right.
Sorry. Really? So the quarter pounder is significantly bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Huh. I wouldn't have I don't know, because to me a quarter pounder is not, because I'm used to Big Macs. To me a quarter pounder isn't that substantial of a hamburger, but.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's like quite a bit more beef. Well, yeah, I mean, there's more beef in a quarter pounder than there is in a Big Mac, even by a small margin. But yeah, I don't know. I don't really like quarter pounders that much.
Yeah.
Had them. Lots. Don't really like them that much.
I think, like, when I ask myself, like, objectively what is good and bad about McDonald's hamburgers, like, the beef is objectively not good. Like, it's not very good. Flavorful, yeah. And it's not juicy, and it's not...
And it's obviously overcooked, and...
Yeah. Like, it's dry, right? And so that's... So it really is, like, it's just what? It's just the convenience and the cost and the... sauce, kind of like that's what it's coming down to, right?
Yeah, the sauce, the bun. I think there's a lot to be said for their bun. It's soft, but it's chewy. They like toast it on the grill.
Yeah, and you can taste
that. Or like on a bun grill.
Yeah.
So it has this like kind of, you know, one side is like toasted and a little bit crispy, and especially if you get one that's fresh.
Yep.
It's like got a nice kind of like crispy caramelized flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a lot of it. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely nothing special about the sauce. Well, except on the Big Mac.
Yep.
That's the specialist of all special sauces. That's the eponymous special sauce. But yeah, so I don't know. Yeah. I think it's the convenience. I think it's like the familiarity. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, the beef's definitely nothing to write home about. Also, I haven't gone to a McDonald's in the States for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I did once or twice when my family was vacationing, like road tripping through the US.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I remember, their buns on their cheeseburgers were not toasted.
Really?
Yeah. And I was stunned.
How old were you?
Couldn't believe it. I'm horrible at that. I'm horrible at remembering how old I was.
But you were a kid, or?
Yeah, ish. Like, probably. Well, it was. It had to have been after I worked at McDonald's, because
right, 'cause how would you
I don't
notice
think
that?
That I probably would have noticed, or I wouldn't have understood what the difference was.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had to have been older than 14, but I'm sure I wasn't 18. So yeah, somewhere in there.
Well, I was going to say, like, you must have been whatever age you were at least some fledgling like gastronome if you noticed something like, do you know what I mean? Like, I think that's something that not a lot of people would pick up on, even though I do think that like the flavor of the toasted bun is actually an important component of the McDonald's taste. But
yeah, totally
weird. Actually, I had a traumatic experience.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry.
No, go on.
No, we can, if you have something else to say about the toasted bun experience.
Okay, we'll get back to your traumatic experience. Okay. Just don't forget what it was, because I'm fascinated to hear it. But yeah, I was just going to say that, like, I think I wouldn't say that when I was a child, I had a sophisticated palate in any way, but I was like very into trying food that I hadn't tried before. Yeah, I don't know. I can remember a lot of instances where I wanted to try things that I'd heard of or, you know, saw a new food that I hadn't seen before.
Right.
And, you know, wanted to give it a try. And, and so, yeah, I think I was always fascinated by food and fascinated by flavors and textures of food. I mean, obviously, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't love everything.
Right.
I think I was just remarking the other day about how I'm pretty sure when I was a kid, I hated olives, but oh my God. Olives, Alan, they're so amazing. Anyway, let's get back to your to your trauma.
So yeah, I had a traumatic experience at an American McDonald's as a child, where we were driving through, I don't know, under the Great Lakes. So we were in Michigan or Wisconsin or something, and we stopped at a McDonald's. And at home, I would always get iced tea. And so I ordered iced tea in this American McDonald's.
Oh God.
And didn't realize that they don't sweeten their tea in the Northern United States. They don't sweeten their iced tea. So it was dry. Like, it was literally just
no,
cold
Alan,
tea.
That's called sweet tea. Well,
I know, oh, in the God. South. Like, yeah. Like, but why isn't it just sweet from Carolina to Canada? Why do they not sweeten it in places like Michigan? It was this, like, I have
the faintest idea. And then that also, sorry, it also begs the question, who would drink cold unsweetened tea? It's horrible.
Yeah. I, like, as a child who had never tasted tea and obviously didn't, yeah, it was like, I thought something was wrong. I thought that they had put dishwater in my cup or something. But my parents tasted it and explained it to me. But I was shocked.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience. It must have been in the States, because I don't think that you would order an iced tea anywhere in Canada and get something that wasn't sweet.
Certainly but, not yeah. in a fast food place. No, like.
No, certainly not.
Like in a tea house, you might. Like at Steep's Tea House, you might be able to get iced tea that's actually just iced tea. But like, yeah, and it's inconceivable to be served non-sweetened iced tea in a fast food restaurant here.
Oh, I'm sorry that happened to you, Alan.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, McDonald's. We both feel guilty.
Yeah.
But there's definitely pleasure to be had there.
Yeah.
What else you got, Alan? I mean, everything that we say today feels like it's a little bit overshadowed by the experience that you shared on our last episode.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of like, maybe I feel like, I don't know. Did we go as deep as we can with that one, or like
the only is it annoying to just, we should briefly recap that, not as lengthily as, but like, We're talking about, we're talking about when you get a donair and it's wrapped in foil and it's served in a plastic bag to catch the...
When anyone gets a donair, right, Alan?
I don't know. That's the only way it's served in Edmonton, isn't it?
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, that's how it's served.
Yes.
I'm sure that's how it's served a lot of places.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, this, the whole experience, this is the universally understood way to enjoy a donair, right? What you're about to talk about?
I don't... I mean, they put the plastic bag there for a reason.
Undoubtedly.
Maybe it's to, so you don't...
It's probably not to keep your upholstery in your vehicle clean. It's probably to collect all the...
So you eat the donair, and as you do so, the sweet sauce dribbles out and pools in the bottom of the plastic bag, along with little bits of onion and iceberg lettuce and maybe tomato and stuff like that.
And probably a little bit of donair meat too.
Possibly, yeah. It pools in the bottom of the bag, but you're eating in public, and so you don't feel comfortable once the donair is gone getting that liquid out of the bottom of the bag, and so you put it in your pocket. You put it in your pocket and you go back to your dorm room and you close the door and you close the blinds and you suck it out of the bottom of the bag. I don't think there's much...
What?
I don't think there's much else to say.
That's it. That's all, right?
Well, the only thing, I think that if I remember, I had like drawn the analogy to eating ortolans that you weren't familiar with. Ortolans, the songbirds.
Right.
Do you remember that or no?
Yes, I do remember you talking about it, and I did not familiarize myself with it.
Well, I'll just so that the analogy is clear. This is the ortolan is a songbird that migrates across the south of France, and it's a delicacy there. And I don't know all the details. I believe it's detailed in one of Bourdain's articles in Medium Raw, I think.
Okay.
The birds are often like force fed to be fattened. And then I think they're sometimes not always like drowned or at least simmered in brandy, and they're eaten whole. You hold them, I guess, by the beak and eat them whole, like bones and all. But there's a tradition of covering your, like you cover your entire head and the bird with a cloth as you eat it. And partly it's because like there's a lot of like sucking and slurping and crunching and all this involved with eating the whole bird.
Right.
But at least the joke is that you're also doing it to hide from God as you do it, because it's such a shameful, gluttonous thing that you're doing. So that's the analogy is that when I go into my dorm and close the door and close the blinds, like I'm hiding from judgment, but I'm
totally,
yeah, I'm hiding.
You get in your bed and hide under your covers and then pour the liquid out.
No, do you know what happens if that stuff gets on bed sheets? It never comes out.
I can't imagine. Okay.
So that's, and you have something to bring to the table.
Oh man, I just like, I don't think that I have anything that rivals that. I can remember like a lot of drunk convenience store meals that I probably, you know, like wouldn't put in my food diary or something. But I don't think, I was having trouble coming up with foods that I wouldn't, that I would like hide that the fact that I ate them from people,
right,
or something. Yeah, the food that I eat or that I would consider a guilty pleasure, that, you know, that I probably don't tell people about is like convenience store food. So yeah. I have like a soft spot for pizza subs from 7-Eleven.
Okay.
They're horrible. It's like the worst kind of like processed cured meat, and you know, it's just, yeah, it's total garbage food. But for some reason I just got, actually it's kind of an interesting story about how I like sort of discovered them.
Kate.
when I was for a period of time when I was working at the Blue Pear restaurant in Edmonton, I was living in Spruce Grove and I was commuting in like every day. And so at the end of work, at the end of service, so like at 11 o'clock or something, I would be driving home to Spruce Grove, and like we always had a staff meal like before service there. And so, you know, we would eat like 4 o'clock or 4:30 or something like that. And then I wouldn't eat anything until after I got off work. And usually our staff meal there was delicious, but not always huge.
Right.
So yeah, lots of times after work, I'd be pretty hungry. I'd be driving home. And then like one night I was driving home and I needed to get gas. And so I stopped at a 7-Eleven that just was on my way. And I got gas and I went in and I was hungry. And then I like went to their sandwich selection. And I think it was like one of the only things in there. And so I just grabbed it and heated it up on my way home. And I, just because I think I was like so hungry, and then, you know, it, like also late night snacking is just like, I don't know. There's something about eating a snack late at night that like adds, I think, maybe an extra layer of like, I don't really know how to articulate it super well, but it make, I feel like it makes the foods that you eat at that time extra addictive or something.
Yeah.
Like, there's a, there's just something about eating that at that time that like, that for me, makes it easy to form a habit.
Especially, I think, if you're coming off of a shift and you haven't eaten during the shift, it's like a, it's almost like a, like a high kind of like you're, you kind of gorge yourself and it feels really good.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, and then I think it's like pretty easy for that to become ritualized.
Yeah.
And so like while I was working at the Blue Pear, I ate a fair few of those sandwiches, like maybe one a week, something like that.
Yeah.
For a long time. And then I rarely eat them now, but the odd time I'm like, I could really go for a 7-Eleven sandwich.
It's actually, it's one of the, this probably could be an episode in its own right, but like the effects of working evenings and getting off work late in the evening, there's fairly predictable things like, you know, all your friends are in bed or all your friends have worked early the next morning. And so you either spend time alone or you, you like the only way that most people hang out at that time of night is by going to a bar. And so obviously that has repercussions and affects your routines and stuff, but actually eating, I find, is it's extremely disruptive to eating, because if I finish work at 4 p.m it feels very normal to go home and cook supper, but when you finish work at 11 or 12 in the evening, like, and it's dark and you're alone and you don't usually feel like going home and cooking a proper meal, and so what's available to you is pizza and donairs and fast food, and often, like not exclusively, but that's, I don't know, for me, like that's, I know that's like a bad habit that affected my well-being when I worked evenings. But
Alan, do you remember the time when you and me and Nate Box and maybe somebody else went to, what was it, All Happy Family Restaurant?
Yeah, it was after we had just like finished a big
particularly late catering event or something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember the event now. I thought maybe it was a conference, or it was something. It was a big event for sure. I definitely remember going to All Happy Family. I know we had Singapore noodles, and I know that you had the fried crab. That's what I remember about it.
Yeah, I ordered the whole fried crab.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that was amazing.
That place is a gem.
It was good. It was really good for food that you just like wander into a restaurant at 1 a.m. in Chinatown in Edmonton and just just order a giant feast. Like, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah. That's, are there lots of, have you ever been to All Happy Family like before 10 p.m. or like Like, have you gone there for a proper dinner?
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah. For me, it's always a place that I end up at. I'm not sure I've been there before midnight, but.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I lived in Vancouver, I went to a lot of Chinese restaurants after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
That was like one of our go-tos was like late night Chinese food, cold tea. You know what cold tea is, right, Alan?
Is it like iced tea?
It's beer in a teapot.
Oh.
And then they give you teacups.
I see. Yep.
Yeah.
Because it's after last call or?
Yeah, because it's late. Yeah, it's after last call. Yeah, I think it's usually, like 3 a.m. or something.
Right. Okay, so are we going here? Like, we're talking about guilty pleasures and late night food and being served after last call. Are we talking about steel wheels now? Is that happening tonight?
Oh, God. Okay, yeah. I don't know. Are there two conversations to be had about steel wheels? Because, like, we've kind of, like, talked about steel wheels amongst ourselves in the past.
Yeah.
And you sort of told me that you kind of had a revelation about it when you went with your Korean friends.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know. It seems like kind of a big one to get into if we're going to get into, you know, like the dichotomy of its late night drunken pizza binge-ness versus its like Korean authenticity.
Suffice to say, for this conversation, the pizza at Steel Wheels, I guess I would call it a guilty pleasure, because if I'm there, I'm going to get pizza, but it is objectively pretty bad. The pizza. But I'm not saying you shouldn't go there. And I have been there many, many times, and I guess we'll leave it at that for today.
Maybe I'll wind up there someday. I have never been. And so I feel like super FOMO, but at the same time, I kind of feel lucky, or I don't know.
Tell me if that's
appropriate.
You've never been there?
Never been.
Can I take you there for your first time?
Oh, I'd love that. Yeah, we should definitely plan that. Okay, yeah. So Steel Wheels, late night. So what's bad about the pizza there?
The dough and the cheese and like the dough, it's the style of like, it's really thick, like white bread dough.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no flavor or texture to it at all. And it's very thick. Like, it's like a slice of pizza is like a loaf of Wonder Bread, kind of.
Okay. Yeah, so is it like fluffy though?
Yeah, it's not
is it like fluffy in that way, or is it like chewy in that way?
I mean, it's certainly not as light as Wonder Bread. And it's not, I'm not saying that it's dense and chewy or anything, but it's just like a huge amount, like an inch thick of just bland white dough. Like, the crust has no texture. It actually, like, the dough kind of reminds me, like Funky Pickle. Do you remember that short-lived pizza chain in Edmonton?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of from a different, I guess, like Edmonton South Side generation than you are. Yeah. But yeah, the Funky Pickle, that was my Steel Wheels.
Yeah. So, and I ate Funky Pickle pizza a lot, but like I don't think anyone would say that they had excellent dough. They had really thick dough and lots of dough, but, and the crust,
kind of chewy and dry a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, the cheese at Steel Wheels, not a fan. But whenever I go, I get bulgogi pizza. So they put bulgogi beef on the pizza. And to get through that crust, who knows what it's going to be like now, but it used to be there was the public condiment counter, squeeze bottles of like teriyaki and ranch, and you load it up with that.
Teriyaki ranch, hey?
No, sorry, those are two sauces. There's like a collection of, there's like hot sauce.
No, I know, but if you put them both on.
Yeah.
Then
fusion.
Okay. Well, I have one more late night eating slash guilty pleasure that I kind of came up with that I feel like is fun to share with you. But like, I have this, well, actually, I haven't done this in a long time. And currently, I don't really eat a whole lot of ice cream at home.
Right. Because you probably eat it constantly.
Fairly obvious reasons, yeah. I think. But I used to have like a really horrible late night snacking habit of putting two scoops of ice cream in a bowl, whatever kind I happen to have on hand, and then just putting everything on it that I could possibly want to snack on or could imagine that might be good to put on my ice cream. So like everything that like might have been in my pantry or in my snack cupboard or whatever. So it'd be like two scoops of ice cream with like smashed up cookies and then like a half a cup of cereal and then like take a spoon of peanut butter and like put the cereal on the outside of the peanut butter and like sort of press that in with the ice cream in the bowl.
Right.
And like maybe there's peanut butter in there, so maybe then I put jam and maybe there's like a little bit of like malt and salt and then some olive oil and balsamic vinegar and then maybe there's potato chips.
That's a joke. No, that's a joke, right? Or no?
No, I'm not kidding. Like
really?
This is all in one. This isn't like one night it's like cookies and the next night it's cereal. It's like take two scoops of ice cream and put like everything on it. Like
can you,
all dressed ice cream.
Can you tell me why? Like why? Like can you, when it's all said and done, like do you taste all those components? Like you can taste peanut butter and olive oil and
yeah, to some extent. Like I think a lot of the time it's like, well, A, it's like adding sort of as much like richness and flavor as possible. I know that like maybe some of those flavors seem incongruent or something, like they wouldn't go together. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, I kind of always have a fascination of trying weird things mm-hmm. together just to see what's going to happen, see what they taste like, see how they interact with each other. I sort of have the way that some people like to keep their food separate on their plate, like mm-hmm. they don't want their peas and carrots to touch or whatever.
Right.
I sort of have an opposite fascination for my foods to commingle and then, mm-hmm. and then, you know, like figure out how they're going to interact, like from like texturally and from a flavor perspective and whatever.
So,
and so I think like part of it is just like, you know, gluttony. And then the other part of it is like just, you know, having all this food around and being fascinated with like, you know, how it goes together.
Mm-hmm. So it was like maybe you're doing research.
I would accidentally make a happy mistake or something.
Yeah. There was one of the places that I worked in Austria had a dessert that was on the menu. It just said ice cream with oil and vinegar.
Oh, yeah.
Which sounds super weird to most people. But it was actually a really beautiful and really elegant dessert. It was like two little scoops of, I guess, relatively plain, but like quite delicious vanilla ice cream. But then one of them had, the oil was Styrian pumpkin seed oil. So like the really deep green, super, super nutty tasting pumpkin seed oil. And then the vinegar was like, it was apple cider vinegar that was aged, well, that was fermented and aged like balsamic. So it was like apple balsamic vinegar from a craft producer in the region. And it was such a fun surprise and like so delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. Vinegar on your ice cream is amazing. For anyone that hasn't tried it, highly recommend.
Does it have to be like balsamic? Like does balsamic mix better with ice cream than like just red wine vinegar or white vinegar?
I mean, white vinegar, not going to be that great, probably. But yeah, I think even apple cider vinegar, haven't actually tried that. But like sherry vinegar, I know for sure. It's like kind of sharp and cutting, but then, you know, the ice cream is like round and sweet and rich. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. They really help each other out. Have you had, we have made... have we done it a couple times now? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we've made a couple. We had it as a feature flavor at Kind Ice Cream. We made an olive oil ice cream, which some people are fanatical about, and some people think is the weirdest, most disgusting.
I've seen it on menus lots. Like, I know that, like, I think either Barbrico or Uccellino had olive oil sorbetto. I'm not sure I've had it, though.
I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of ours. It's really good.
Okay. I'll
it's check. Not actually on the menu, though, but we'll probably bring it back. It's one of the faves. It's one of the owners is one of the faves.
Oh, really?
Okay. What else, Alan? Are you all out of guilty pleasures? You can't be.
I think that kind of in the, along the lines of, like there being certain brands or industrial like products that you're supposed to avoid as a chef. Feel like I've shed most of my guilt about that. Like things like just drinking cheap mass produced beer. Like there was a phase where I would have been actually ashamed to be seen drinking Canadian or Pabst or whatever.
Right.
I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like either you would feel pressure to like have something microbrewed and local, and I still do enjoy all of that, but like I wouldn't turn down a Pabst or hide that I was drinking a Pabst or
totally or make fun of someone for offering it to you.
Yeah. Oh, like exactly. And that ties into our conversations about food snobs, right? Yeah. Like I like craft beer and there's no stigma to mass produced beer to me.
I mean, personally, if I'm choosing, I would have trouble choosing Molson Canadian. I don't really like it that much, but you know, not because of a stigma, just because I don't really think it's good beer.
No.
And there is so much good beer available now, especially like I think that there used to not be a ton of really great beer available in Alberta specifically, but man, in the last 5 years, it's five even longer, I guess, but
yeah, totally.
Yeah. Like in the last 5 or 10 years, it's just, there are so many great microbreweries.
So maybe it's this is maybe a good transition to the next topic, but like, What I meant is that, like, I don't consider Molson Canadian a guilty pleasure because it's not that. I mean, it's not that pleasurable.
It's guilty, but it's not a pleasure.
But the thing is that I don't feel guilty drinking it. But people might try and shame me for drinking it and like say, why aren't you drinking a local craft beer?
It's hard for me to separate out like what food shaming type of feelings I have from working in the food industry, or whether those things also exist just in the general public. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that it's worse in the food industry.
Yeah.
You know, you're confronted with it more. There are a lot more people that have a lot more opinions about what you should and should not be eating and, you know, what's good and what's bad. And, you know, and I feel the same way you do. I used to feel a lot more ashamed about eating and drinking lowbrow food or, you know, even stuff that's like maybe not organic or something than I do now. I feel now like life's too short to feel bad about taking pleasure in the times that I can enjoy, you know, the food that I'm eating or whatever. Like it's precious. I don't feel like I need to harbor any guilt about it or anything. I wonder if I do still. I mean, definitely in terms of environmental impact and stuff like that, I still do sometimes feel not good about some of the food choices that I make. But
like, what are some examples of shaming, say, from within industry or without? But
right. Well, like a couple I can think of, like mostly or like a lot of the ones that I can think of are, you know, chefs of mine calling me out for eating fast food, like for, you know, picking up Kentucky Fried Chicken or something like that.
Right.
And then me feeling bad about it, like I like it's lazy or I shouldn't be doing it. Actually, like I think, oh yeah, here's a big one. Actually, there's sort of an attitude in the industry, I think, that, you know, good cooks and, you know, cooks who love food, you know, cook at home for themselves all the time. You know, on their off days, like they're at home cooking. Mm-hmm. And for me, that hasn't always been the case. It's been really up and down. There are like phases where, you know, I'm really into cooking at home and really love doing it and put a lot of effort into buying groceries and coming up with lunch and dinner ideas. And I mean, I always cook breakfast for myself almost, like even in phases where I don't really feel like cooking at home very much. I usually always make breakfast for myself, but yeah, there have been lots of times when, you know, the job is really long hours and, you know, like maybe really stressful or something. And then on my days off, I just feel like I would just feel like I didn't have the energy to really cook for myself. Yep. And so on my days off, I would wind up eating out pretty much invariably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for like long periods of times, like sometimes for a year or something, I would like barely ever cook at home aside from like making myself eggs for breakfast or something like that. And yeah, like I feel like that's a pretty big one, I guess. Like I think during a lot of those periods when I'm not really cooking at home, that's probably something that I tried to hide from some people because I felt like they would look down on me for, you know, not being dedicated enough to be like always cranking out meals. Is that, I guess that's not really probably similar for you, because most of your cooking career, you've kind of like had a family. So it's a little bit different, I guess, probably, right?
Yeah. For about half of it, I've had a child at least. So yeah, now there's no question, like we've talked about it before, like that's kind of our family is centered around mealtime, cooking, food preparation. So yeah, that's certainly like I cook at home constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I think I more or less have, it doesn't matter. Like I've seen both ends of the spectrum. I know professional cooks who like do not cook at home. They just like leave work and don't want to think about it until the next day. And others who, like me, I was most often cooking for myself and Lisa, my partner. Yeah, like we would go out, but we've never been a couple or a family that eats out even every week, like even once a week. Like we are primarily just cooking at home.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know if, you know, like I'd be curious to know if there are, I don't know, listeners of ours who are chefs, what they think about that, like whether they feel like, you know, it's that there's pressure to cook at home, or whether that's just me feeling that pressure or something. I'm curious.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a story about that, drop it on our Instagram. I'm super curious to read it.
I think I've definitely intentionally shamed cooks about eating habits and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like usually done in a kind of, it's usually framed in a kind of jesting, ribbing kind of way. But I usually, like, for instance, one of the ones for so many years at like places like Elm Cafe and District Cafe and Little Brick and all of those black box hospitality shops, like coffee was so central to the identity of the locations. Like it was like this curated high quality coffee roaster. And so usually when I was working at places like that, or like working in the kitchens that supported those places, if people rolled in with Starbucks, I would usually call them out and say like,
yeah,
do you realize where you work and like the quality of the coffee that you have access to for free? Like, and you're paying $5 for a latte every day. So I would like kind of ridicule them for the financial irresponsibility of it, as well as the gastronomical yeah. So I like, it was, like I said, it was usually, maybe this is true of a lot of the conversations I have with people. It was like phrased as a joke, but not, maybe not necessarily intended to be a joke. Which is probably very confusing for the people.
Yeah, like I was going to say that I'm sure that I've done the same thing. I know for a fact that I've coffee shamed people.
Maybe that's just more. Maybe I learned it from you.
A food snobbery thing than an industry thing. Because I don't know. To me, it seems like a shame to drink McDonald's coffee when there's, I don't know, when it's so easy to get good coffee. But I mean, it's easier, obviously, to get McDonald's coffee.
So is it different though? Like. So for instance, I don't always have, like I don't work at a place that has great coffee anymore. And the coffee that I keep at home is not necessarily that like super high quality, third wave, locally roasted kind of stuff.
Say what?
Well, yeah, you heard me. it's expensive shill. I'm not usually a frugal guy when it comes to food and drink, but like it's expensive. But sorry, I'm getting off topic. But it just seemed like when we're working at a place where like, I actually felt like part of the identity of the businesses had to do with like the quality of the coffee that was being served. It just seemed like a really, like a slap in the face. Absolutely. To see Starbucks, cups coming into the shop. But
I don't want to condone shaming people for anything. And I don't think that like, you know, I don't know if there's a legitimate way in which you should be, you know, shaming your coworkers. But like, I think part of the rationale or like why it sort of like takes hold in kitchens is maybe because like if in the situation with the coffee, you know, if you can tell the difference between Starbucks coffee and the coffee that was being served at Elm Cafe or any of those other cafes, and you appreciate that difference, and maybe part of the reason why you're working there is because you appreciate that someone pays enough attention to detail that the, you know, that the coffee service is, you know, important and that good. Then if someone else that you're working with is drinking Starbucks, like you maybe. Maybe it's an indication that they don't understand the difference,
right?
Or something like that, which probably isn't actually the case. That person is probably either like fully does understand the difference, or at the very least is completely capable of understanding the difference. But, you know, it's probably some other circumstance that led them to go through the Starbucks drive-through, or I don't know, force of habit or whatever. So I think that's sort of the thing, is that the implication is that if you're eating bad food, then maybe you don't understand what good food is. And if you don't understand what good food is, and I do, then like, what are you doing working side by side with me? I think that's sort of like where the shaming culture kind of takes root or something.
But it still could be a kind of teachable moment. But maybe shame is not the best way to make the point.
Yeah, absolutely.
No? Or you think it just shouldn't be touched?
No. Absolutely. If you think that someone that you are working with can learn something from you about the quality of food or something like that, I think teachable moments are great and super important, and sharing information is, you know, one of the best things that we can do. But yeah, shame is probably not the right approach. I mean, maybe for some person it is, but
sometimes it's funny though.
I mean, yeah, obviously. But sometimes it's also hurtful. Maybe it's funny to you, but it's hurtful to somebody else, and that's not, that's sad. But I know what you mean. I think also it is possible to joke around about it and have it not be hurtful. You know, if both parties are kind of like, you could shame me and I wouldn't feel bad about it. And I feel like I could shame you about something and you wouldn't feel bad about it because we both don't care and we both know that we're joking. But, you know, that's not always the circumstance.
I think that the way that I did it was usually I don't think I hurt anybody's feelings. But maybe Jen can write it and say if it was different than that.
Oh, no. I'm sure Jen didn't give a shit what you had to say about her coffee drinking habits.
No. It certainly didn't change any habits, so.
Yeah, Jen's got her own things. She's happy doing what Jen's yep. doing. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I bungled your segue before.
That was like half an hour ago. I know.
But we do have another related mini topic, and it does revolve around shaming.
It's kind of like the initial incident was a shaming moment, right?
I wouldn't say that, like, I'll reveal the topic before we get into really digging into it. It's about microwave shaming. So
you said that as if it were just a topic that people have heard about before and
haven't they? I feel like it's pervasive. Yeah, I just like I think that it's interesting, and it ties into like the same type of feelings I think in kitchens that a lot of cooks, you know, hate using microwaves and look at it as you know, like an evil device that's the enemy of food quality or something like that. And I definitely also used to feel that way. And mm-hmm. I definitely, in plenty of kitchens that I worked in, didn't want to use the microwave, like always talked about how we should take the microwave out of the kitchen. It's like, I got over it. At some point, I started to realize that actually,
like, you would walk into a kitchen and see a microwave and be like, what is that doing here?
Yeah, I would make stupid jokes
either
during service.
Either that goes, like, or I go.
Well, I wasn't usually a shot caller, so I wasn't usually like, I didn't usually have the power to make the decision about whether we should have a microwave or not. And then by the time I was a shot caller, a microwave was like my best friend. Well, maybe yes. not, but definitely my, I don't know, my dislike or disregard of microwaves like went away at some point, because at some point I realized that it's just a tool. But I think that that's sort of a, I don't know, like that still exists. Am I right, Alan? That yes. people think that microwaves are dirty, horrible enemies of food quality. Isn't that a thing?
Yeah. I've met at least a few people who consider it a point of personal pride that they do not own a microwave.
Right. Cooks, you mean?
Not necessarily. Some cooks, okay. But some not. People who don't cook or people who don't cook professionally still have opinions on it.
Yeah. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that maybe like the set of negative opinions about microwaves among cooks and the set of negative opinions about microwaves among non-cooks are sort of two different sets of opinions. Like maybe I feel like amongst non-cooks, more the opinion is that like it's bad for you or something to eat food that's been cooked in a microwave.
Is that something that people believe?
I don't know. That's the sense that I get. Like people that don't want to have a microwave in their house for cooking food. I don't know why I think that, but I think that that's part of it.
Do you know someone who thinks it's unsafe to eat food that was cooked in a microwave?
I've definitely heard people say that. I can't think off the top of my head of specific people or specific examples, but yeah, I think that that's kind of a somewhat common belief.
Shale, that's not true though.
No, it's not true.
It's not even it's not true at all.
I know, like you and I know that, but there's a lot of information there's a lot of erroneous information on the internet.
So I wouldn't have thought that that was the primary reason for non-cooks to shun microwaves. I thought it was kind of in the same, like coming from the same place as the cooks, where it's just like, it's like this lazy convenience product that anyone who takes their home seriously wouldn't need.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Yeah, well, I certainly believe you. But yeah, that's to me like more of the cook negative attitudes towards microwaves
right.
are.
Is yeah, that, totally.
Yeah, it's lazy. It like doesn't reheat things evenly, so you get like really bad quality food out of it because some of it's cooked and some of it's not, or something like that.
Like maybe we should start listing its strong points, because it actually, to me, like for small portions, it heats much more evenly than like say a bowl of soup in a microwave versus a bowl of soup on a gas range. Like of course the microwave heats it more evenly, right?
Oh yeah, undoubtedly.
Okay.
Like for
let's just start listing its merits.
For liquids, yeah, for liquids, for reheating liquids, microwaves are amazing. Like
yeah,
fast and, you know, even. And like one of the benefits is that you can usually reheat something in the container that it's already in.
Exactly. Yep. Less dishes. Yep. You don't have to transfer it to a pot and then into a bowl. Yep.
And like, yeah, I think that they're good for reheating. I do think that, you know, if you're not, you have to apply a little bit of care, the same way that you would with reheating anything. But mm-hmm. I think that, well, like for instance, one thing that I tend to use my microwave for at home. Wait, before I go on, I have a little story about my microwave at home that I want to inject in here because it's part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this topic.
Okay.
And it has to do with microwave shaming. And I just, you know, like I want to get it out of my system before we go on to talking about the great things about microwaves and how awesome they are.
Okay.
So when I first moved into my house, I posted a picture on my Instagram of me standing in the kitchen. It's like when the house that I'm living in now was a new build, and when we moved in, we were the first owner, so it was like a brand new kitchen. Mm-hmm. It's not like spectacular or anything, but it's a nice kitchen. Like it has like decent appliances, and it has like stone countertops, and it's mm-hmm. has a dishwasher, which is dope. But yeah, I was like excited, and I posted a picture of me standing smiling in my kitchen, like saying, oh, I just moved into a house or something, like have a new kitchen. And a friend of mine from way back, who I haven't spoken to in quite a while, named Rob Baxter, posted a comment on that picture saying, nice microwave, man. And I didn't respond at the time. And actually, I think that at the time, you know, there was a lot going on. I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention to my socials. I was like more into moving into my house and, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with that whole thing. But I don't know if at the time that I realized that it was Rob who had said it. And I just thought it was kind of like a random person who was just microwave shaming me. And I was just like, really? Like, just on Instagram, random people are just gonna like shame you for having a microwave. Like mm-hmm. this just seems so crazy to me. And I don't know, it like has been gnawing away at me ever since. Every time I put food in that microwave, I'm like,
yeah,
yeah, I have a microwave and I'm using it and I'm heating stuff up in here and it's good. So you know what, rando from the internet, I love my microwave. Oh, anyways,
man. We should make bumper stickers, like microwave pride bumper stickers.
Yeah, 100% we should.
But so sorry, it was a friend of yours, and so it's hard to know the intended tone of something like an Instagram comment. Do you think he was microwave shaming you?
Yeah, 100%. I don't know, like looking back on it now, maybe, well, I don't think that I think that he was probably like jokingly microwave shaming me. Like, I don't think that, you know, like I doubt that he was like complimenting me on my microwave, because every microwave is exactly the same as every other microwave. So I don't think that there's.
Do you believe that what you just said? I'm just kidding.
I mean, no, obviously, but to a certain extent, yes.
Because I would have said something similar about, say, dishwashers, which you mentioned, until I got a Miele dishwasher and I was like, oh, this is actually 10 times better than any other dishwasher I've ever seen in my entire life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I can definitely see that in something like a dishwasher. And I think that there's
or a
like,
Dyson vacuum.
Well, yeah, Dyson vacuums are way better than any other vacuum. Even tiny little ones are like way better than like expensive big vacuums, like ridiculous. But yeah, I think like for microwaves, maybe there's like three tiers, but within those tiers, it's like they all do exactly the same thing. They all try to differentiate themselves in ways that make them suck.
Right.
But really they all just do the same thing and you use them for the same thing. So it's kind of funny.
What are you running, like 900 watts or what?
pretty sure it's 12.
I'm just kidding. Okay.
But yeah, I mean like the tiers are like tiny, cheap, like, you know, I don't know how powerful those ones are, but like they're like, you know, really little and really cheap and plasticky, and they're like, I don't know, probably 700 or 800 watts or something like that, and they take quite a while to heat up food. And then there's like the regular sort of residential microwaves that I think are like around 1,000 or 1,100 watts, and that are in most people's houses, and they, you know, take about a minute and a half to 2 minutes to boil a cup of water or something like that. And then commercial ones are a little more powerful and a little less bells and whistles, which is kind of nice.
That's something that actually, like, microwaves have, they always have 50 more buttons than they need.
Oh my God.
Like, they always have like the pizza button and the popcorn button and the, like, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah. The microwave in my house actually is like somewhat infuriating because it has a bunch of modes where you can cook things with a temperature probe.
Oh, really?
But yeah, but the temperature probe is like sold separately or something. So it doesn't come with, or at least it didn't come with ours. So I don't know if the person who unpacked it threw it in the garbage or if it just legit, you have to buy the temperature probe separately. But like there's a whole bunch of buttons on the front of the microwave. First of all, the front of my microwave has about like 400 buttons on it. And then like there's like three rows of buttons at the top that basically only work if you cook something with the temperature probe.
Right.
They're like, you know, and like, I guess how that works is like, it's checking the internal temperature of something while you're cooking it. And then once your chicken gets to way overcooked, then it's like, bing, your chicken's ready.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's infuriating because it takes up like a whole bunch of the space on the microwave for buttons, and every time I go to cook something I'm like I just want to put in the time, can I just put in
yeah,
anyway, Rob, if you're listening, thanks for hating on my microwave. Gave me a lot to think about. Now let's get back to the great things about microwaves.
So at home, like I use the microwave, especially because I'm cooking for kids. I use the microwave basically every meal.
What do you mostly use it for?
My daughter for breakfast has porridge, like oats and brown sugar. And so that's cooked in the microwave because I can, from the time that I say, Cora, do you want your breakfast now? Till the time that it's on the table is less than 2 minutes. So like on mornings where we're getting ready for school and stuff, it's like a godsend. Can like put oats and brown sugar and a pinch of salt in a bowl with water, put it in the microwave, set it for 60 seconds, and then like cut up the apple, get the plates, pour a glass of water, like all that stuff. And then like it's on the table.
Are these instant oats or?
No, they're rolled oats.
Rolled oats. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know you could do rolled oats in a microwave in 60 seconds. That's amazing.
Huh. Maybe you don't have the right microwave. Maybe I can talk to you about that. I'm just kidding. And then, yes, a lot of the stuff for our kids, like because they can be picky eaters, we always have stuff in the freezer that we know they like peas and corn and frozen blueberries and stuff like that. So those go into the microwave. Like I use it a lot at home. But yeah, it's going into the professional space where you start to see resistance, and I start to like doubt myself if it's appropriate to suggest using a microwave to accomplish a task because people think that then you're a hack.
Right.
it's so great for, yeah, heating small portions, small quantities fast, and like avoiding waste. So like we can, if we have a soup, we have a soup on the menu at Ernest right now, and some nights we don't sell it. Some nights we sell one, some nights we sell whatever. But
yeah,
the way that it's always been done there is like there's a soup tureen at the pass and like a little cold table for soup garnishes. And like the expediting chef is supposed to heat the soup and keep it in this tureen, and he plates it like during the service. But if you're only going to sell one, like what's the point in firing up a tureen and putting a liter of soup in it when like it's not going to, you're just hot holding soup for no one to order. So why wouldn't you just microwave right. a single
portion
of soup?
And then after you hot hold it all night, you're probably going to wind up throwing it out or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Instead
yeah, yeah.
of just heating up what you need.
But like the idea of suggesting that we heat soup in a microwave to order is unbecoming of a fine dining restaurant. So like I'm loath to suggest it, but.
Like, did you actually suggest it and run into that problem? Or are you just like kind of mulling it over and you're like, fuck, we should heat up the soup in the microwave, but I don't want to tell these guys that.
there was one person I suggested it to, like who was running the station that night. And yeah. they didn't want to do it. They said, well, this is how we did it, you know, last time or whatever. So, but it gets even more interesting when it's like, okay, heating a cup of soup, whatever. But like, I think that you have experience in restaurants where they like are heating their actual vegetable sides in the microwave and maybe their fish. Am I yeah. making that up? I am.
I don't specifically remember the fish thing.
That might be a different
that you're talking about. It's entirely possible that it's a story that I told you that I just have forgotten about, but yeah, I don't specifically remember that one, but I do know that at the Blue Pear, a fair few of our vegetable sides, we heated up in a microwave. So we would like have them in a bag with like seasonings and some fat that they would be in or whatever. And then, we would heat them up just long enough to like kind of create some steam in the bag. And then that would, you know, like quickly steam the vegetables and have them hot really quickly so that they could go on the plate, like sort of last thing so that they wouldn't lose their color and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it's really good for that.
Yeah.
We actually had a dish at the Blue Pear, that utilized the microwave that I don't think that you could do with any other cooking method.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that it required a microwave to be able to pull it off.
Okay.
And I think the original recipe may have come from Chef Steps.
Okay.
I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think it might have been a Chef Steps recipe. Sort of in the height of modernist sort of cooking or whatever. In its like trendy heyday. But the dish was chocolate cake, and you made basically a cake batter, but instead of I wish I could remember the recipe off the top of my head, but I don't exactly remember it. I think instead of eggs it had a different type of stabilizer in it. But you basically make cake batter. We were making chocolate cake, and you take like the chocolate cake batter and put it in a whipped cream siphon, and then you charge the whipped cream siphon, and then you dose a little bit of cake batter out of the whipped cream siphon into like a little porcelain cup or a little plastic cup. And then you have to use a plastic cup because you need to be able to cut holes in the bottom of the cup for steam to escape.
Okay.
So you poke a few little holes in the bottom of the cup, you dose in a small amount of cake batter, you put it in the microwave for literally, I think it was like 15 or 20 seconds. And because there's so much air contained in the batter from coming out of the whipped cream siphon, it just like puffs up into this like super airy, like incredibly light with like giant air round, beautiful air bubbles in it, kind of chocolate cake that's like incredibly moist and like super light. And then you just break it apart into like little chunks. We were like plating it kind of like a little dirt pile sort of thing. You like pull the cake out and break it into little.
Is that what it said on the menu?
I think, I can't remember. But yeah, we would break the cake into chunks. So there'd be like four or five, like decently sized chunks of cake. And then, and yeah, it was just, it's like, first of all, it's like totally fresh because you just quote unquote baked it. Right, and then, yeah. And so it's like warm and still super moist because it literally just came out and then it goes to the table. And yeah, it was really good. And I don't think that you could do that dish any other way.
Like not in a steamer, you don't think?
I mean, a steamer would be the closest thing, but like the size of the air bubbles that you get on the inside, I think only happens because the microwave is cooking. You know, if you did it in a steamer, it would still be cooking it from the outside in. Right, but because you're cooking it into the microwave, you know, parts of the inside get hot before any of the surrounding areas do. And then like it forms the steam and then it forms these like big air bubbles.
Is that okay? I would have said that the microwave cooking from the inside out is another microwave myth. I don't think that's true.
Oh, no.
I'm not saying like I think it could be that the microwave produces like a much better, like airier crumb to that cake, but I don't think that it actually cooks from the inside out.
Oh no, I think it does. Well, it doesn't cook from the inside out. It cooks the outside and the inside at the same time.
Or more close to the same time. Like
more close to the same time because not using heat.
It's not using heat conduction from the outside to the inside. It's the microwaves are able to penetrate.
Exactly. And it's not just penetrating. It doesn't just penetrate the surface first and then work its way in. The microwaves go
right
through the food entirely. And then where they, from what I understand, I'm not a physicist, but from what I understand, it's where they intersect. Like, they're like polarized in a certain way, and where they intersect is like where they interact with the molecules in the food, so be it water or fat or whatever they happen to be interacting with, and that can be anywhere in the food. Like they don't bounce off the surface of, I mean, I'm sure that there are some foods that are better at deflecting some microwaves than other foods, but yeah, for the most part the microwaves are just passing through the food, and so it's heating the inside and the outside, everything all at the same time.
Right. Okay. Because some people do say it cooks from the inside out, which I don't think is correct.
Yeah, that is definitely not correct.
Okay. Phew.
The only thing that cooks from the inside out is what, like a hot poker or something?
Like if you put a hot poker into something to cook it, is that what you mean?
Exactly. That would be from the inside out. What's that?
Have you ever had or heard of ale flip?
No, I don't think so.
It's an old-timey drink. Like a hot drink of, I think it's ale with, maybe it has brandy and stuff in it as well.
Okay, but that's what I would have assumed when you said ale flip. I was like, yeah, that sounds like
it. But they heat a hot poker and they dunk it right into the mug of ale and it like sizzles very violently and heats it almost instantly.
Yeah, that's how you cook from the inside out.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, just stash that one away.
Have you had an ale flip?
Yeah, I made one. I like read about it in an old, I don't know, in a Reader's Digest book or something. And then I tried to make it.
Yeah. Was it delicious?
Yeah. Like it was, if I remember, like it was like brown ale and sugar and brandy.
Sounds like a real wintry drink.
Yeah. It was part of I think I wrote about it on Button Soup. It was like part of a Christmas, like an advent calendar Christmas series or something. I can't remember, but it was fine.
Last question about the ale flip. When you heat it up, does the beer just like foam up or what happens there? I would think sticking a hot poker in a glass of beer would just make it foam up over the top of the glass.
No, that didn't happen. So why that would be, if you heat beer on the stove, like it doesn't produce a foam head, right? Yeah. Because no, I think that like the intense heat, like the foam is not stable because it's becoming so hot so quickly. Do you know what I mean? Like the bubbles and the foam and aren't stable because they're expanding because they're being heated really aggressively.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you're right though. When you heat beer in a like pot, it doesn't really necessarily foam up.
Yeah. We're out of our depth again.
Okay. Yeah. That's the end of science class for today. We learned nothing.
We are all dumber for having
we've solved absolutely no problems and answered absolutely no questions. And I use my microwave at home like pretty often. One of my favorite uses for it is that like I tend to cook in batches, and I'll like cook big batches of things and then use them to make different meals with or take them for as leftovers for my lunches or things like that. So you know, like if I'm, for instance, this week I cooked a sous vide pork loin roast. Mm-hmm. And so I sous vided the whole roast, and we had two chops out of it for dinner one night. And then I have two chops left in my fridge right now, which are already cooked, and like would be, and I don't want to overcook them by like by cooking them again. And one option for me would be to set up my sous vide bath again and, you know, set it to the same temperature or slightly lower than I had cooked them to originally, and then drop them in there for half an hour or 45 minutes to get them back to the same temperature without overcooking them, and then take them out and either pan sear them or sear them on the grill or something like that. But I mean, when it's mealtime, like, and I want to do something quickly, I want to quickly have a couple pork chops, like putting them in the microwave just to warm them up a little bit, so that, you know, they're not fridge cold, then they're just like, you know, they're just like slightly warmed through, but like definitely not hot or cooked. Just like get them up in temperature a little bit so that they're basically as warm as I'm going to want them to be when I eat them, and then throw them on the grill. Basically, all I have to do is put grill marks on them. I wouldn't do that serving dinner in a restaurant probably, but for cooking at home, it's just like such an easy tactic to like be able to take what would be like a half an hour dinner preparation step and turn it into a couple of minutes. Like, I do that type of stuff like fairly often, like slightly reheat something before I'm actually going to finish it or something like that, so that I don't have to spend a lot of time and care, you know, heating it to a specific point or something like that. And I mean, there's microwave popcorn too. That's a thing.
Well, that's funny. Like I, even though I've been valiantly defending the microwave throughout this conversation, like I don't buy microwave popcorn. And I like we make popcorn, but we always make it on the stove.
Yeah, I do both. And I obviously recognize that stovetop popcorn is superior. It's so quick and easy sometimes to pop a bag in the microwave.
Do you mean stovetop is superior just because like you're not dealing with like the flavors of the pre-made Orville Redenbacher microwave stuff, or is there something about the process that actually,
like, that's part of it? But oftentimes when I buy microwave popcorn, I buy like totally plain. And there's still, I think that there has to be some oil in the bag, so I'm sure there's like vegetable oil in there, but not not like butter flavor. And then I just add my own butter.
So you mean that the actual texture of popping it in the pot on the stove is better than, like, it's crispier or something?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. I don't know. Oh, it like feels like the microwave popcorn to me always feels just like a little too airy or something. I don't know. Really? Yeah, like it has like a frail or like almost non-existent texture or something. Like I find that, yes, popcorn popped in an air popper or on the stovetop, it has like a more, like, it just has a little bit fluffier but chewier type of texture than microwave popcorn, which I think like is a little more brittle and like almost too airy or something. I don't know.
It's been a long, long time since I've had microwave popcorn.
Yeah, so I would need to get another microwave popcorn connoisseur on here and ask them about it if you haven't had it in a long time. We should do a side by side though. I'm curious now about whether I'm just making that up or whether it's a real thing. But yeah, it would be fun to do a side by side.
Blind, obviously.
Blind popcorn tasting and see if we can pick out the microwave kind. I'll bet you I can.
How much do you bet?
I'll bet you a Coke.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.